Jews knew how to survive, and now we've returned. Do you know how Jews still survive? They survive in the text. The art of composing is one that comes through some kind of nearly divine channel, divine inspiration, but it's depicted as the immediate, intense reaction to pain and loss and anxiety and suffering. That, at least, is the art of writing for Agnon. Everything about him, from his name to his date of birth to the date of his aliyah, his arrival in the land of Israel, everything was mythologized. Everything was part of the fable the author crafts about his own identity. Creativity, in all its forms, is the most authentic Jewish response to pain, to catastrophe, to exile, to destruction. I always regarded myself as one who was born in Jerusalem, said S.Y. Shai Agnon at the 1966 ceremony where he received the Nobel Prize for Literature. This claim, of course, is complete fiction. It's a work of imagination, a product of Agnon's fortuitous midrashic mind. One of Judaism's greatest literary talents and modern Hebrew literature's undisputed master, perhaps his greatest literary achievement is a kind of fictionalized, mythologized, midrashicized autobiography of himself, a character who is inserted into virtually all of his own stories. Of course, Agnon was not born in Jerusalem, but in the small Galician town of Buchach in 1887. Buchach is a small town, not exactly a shtetl, but far from a big city in today's western Ukraine, but at the time Agnon was born there, it was the easternmost reaches of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Agnon was born into a completely traditional Orthodox home, and he quite unusually set his sights on reaching the pinnacle of artistic and literary achievement. First writing in Yiddish, but very quickly turning to the new reawakened or the so-called revived Hebrew language. This was a very curious choice. At the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, the audience of Yiddish literature numbered in the many millions. The audience of people able and willing to read modern Hebrew literature numbered perhaps in the few tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 at the outset. But nevertheless, Agnon committed himself to becoming the great Hebrew author of modern Hebrew literature. And this may have had something to do with what drew him to the shores of Jaffa to emigrate, to make aliyah to Eretz Yisrael in 1908 at the age of 20. And begin his meteoric rise, which would bring him to the stage in Stockholm nearly 60 years later to receive a Nobel Prize. As our course unfolds over the next few weeks, I'll return to other stations in his biography, and we'll stop to talk about different elements and motifs and styles and the overall scope and arc of his writing project, his long career. Agnon had a career that spanned well over 60 years. He seems to never have suffered a day's writer's block in his life. And because of the support of his patron, Shlomo Zalman Shokin, he was able to dedicate himself from a relatively young age full time to his craft without having to worry about earning a living, which is, of course, the great distraction of so many artists. So at the moment, I'll abbreviate some of that biography. aside from saying that his major artistic achievement was the sustained engagement with the continuity of Jewish literary output, from the Bible and its commentaries to the rabbinic literature, the Mishnah, the Talmud, both the halachic as well as the agadic sections, medieval Hebrew writing, legal, philosophical, poetic, both religious and secular Hebrew poetry, the writing of the early modern period, the Haskalah, the so-called Jewish Enlightenment. Of course, Hasidic literature plays a significant role, and the Yiddish and few Hebrew authors who preceded him and who were the authors who first depicted the confrontations of Judaism with modernity and used their art, as Agnon did, to explore those thorny and colossal questions of Jewish life and existence. He absorbed the entirety of the Jewish canon, distilling it and then casting it into the mold of modern literature. Often, the uninitiated will read Agnon and think that he's doing a kind of retelling of a pious old tale or a Hasidic fable, and not realizing exactly how profoundly modernized the story has become in his retelling, or in his making up from scratch and telling to begin with. The story that we'll read for next week, The Fable of the Goat, is a perfect example of this. On first blush, in fact, it's a story that school children are often initiated into their encounter with Agnon through this particular short story. If you read it, you'll understand why it's a story that could easily be a children's tale, as well as a very profoundly modern and complex story. A story like that, if understood merely as a retelling of a pious old fable, entirely misses the point, as I hope we'll discuss next week. But his ongoing intertextual dialogue, this form of, again, modern midrash in the service of producing an aesthetic work of literary art, which speaks to his own moment and the generations that follow, including ours, this is the defining element of his work. There can be no doubt that the Nobel Prize in 1966 was a major event for the Jewish world at large, and for Israel in particular. Remember, the young Jewish state at that moment was only 18 years old. It was 6 months away from the miraculous Six-Day War. Agnon was the first Israeli to win a Nobel in any field. In the meantime, we've won many Nobel Prizes in a whole variety of subjects, in the sciences, of course, and in economics, and even three prizes in peace, which is somewhat ironic, as that is the one achievement that still somewhat fully evades us. But he is, to this day, the only Hebrew author to receive the Nobel amongst any nationality. Of course, there are many other Jewish authors who have won the Nobel Literature Prize. According to my counting, I think there are 16 literature laureates who are Jewish or claim Jewish connection, some of them writing in very distinctly Jewish registers. A number of years after Agnon wins the prize, 10 years later in 76, Sol Bellow wins the Nobel. 2 years after that, for writing in Yiddish, Isaac Bashevis Singer. And even, I guess, according to some, just 5 years ago, Bob Dylan. An argument can be made that he can make a claim to be a producer of some form of Jewish literature, but that might be the topic for some subsequent course. In Israel, Agnon's award was viewed as a major diplomatic coup. It was a ripe opportunity for the young state to show its achievements in the cultural realm, as a cultural force on the world stage. Let us recall that 1966 is a mere blip, a blink, a historical fraction of a moment from the events that had taken place in Europe just 20-some-odd years before. As such, the prize was perceived as recognition not only of the Jewish people's physical survival, having walked out of Auschwitz and reconstituted itself and built a state, but of the spiritual survival, the cultural survival as a nation. The idea that we could have undergone that most grotesque of all historical traumas, and then within 2 decades, send one of our authors off to Stockholm to receive this prize, was a sign of the self-reconstitution of the Jewish people as a sovereign nation. That such an enemy, when forced to, can best its enemies on the battlefield, but no less significantly develops a meaningful culture. It might be said with some certainty that the Swedish Academy had never seen a laureate quite like Agnon. The way the ceremony works is that upon your name being called, the recipient of the prize rises, walks to the podium, accepts the prize from the hands of the King of Sweden himself, shakes his hand. That's the expectation. That's the extent of the entire action. You're meant to turn around and go back to your seat. Agnon took the opportunity to engage in an extended conversation with King Gustav of Sweden. I always imagine it like what you see on the Academy Awards. The winner gets the prize, they go up to the podium, they're meant to make a 45-second speech, and then the music starts playing to make sure that the speaker doesn't go on too long. So Agnon is standing there, he's talking with King Gustav, the trumpets are blaring, da-da-da-da-da-da, and he's going on and on and on. At this point, Agnon was quite an elderly man. He was nearing 80, which I hasten to point out, back in the 60s, you know, 80 was much older than it is today. Usually, the average age of a recipient of the Nobel in Literature is a bit younger. Usually, the winner of the Nobel Prize still has another novel or two left in them. Agnon would pass away just 3.5 years after receiving the prize. Agnon was a kind of short, portly man, looking somewhat ridiculous in his tuxedo and tails and white tie. King Gustav was very tall and lean, and he has a little hard of hearing. He has to lean over and cup his ear to hear what Agnon is talking to him. Presumably they're talking in German, the only common language they would have had. Agnon is shuckling away. The king is listening. You know, Freud has this idea in his book on humor that there's something inherently comical about the juxtaposition of a short and round fellow and a tall and skinny guy together. So the whole scene itself is just visually humorless. Later during his speech, Agnon famously recited the blessing upon seeing a king. And no doubt the significance and theatrics of this occasion were not lost on the Hebrew author. Agnon shared the prize with Nelly Sachs, who was a German-Jewish poetess who had escaped Germany, had been living in Stockholm, which presumably is how the committee was more familiar with her writing, and had been writing epic lyrical poetry about the Holocaust. Agnon was not terribly happy about the idea of sharing the prize with Sachs, who I should mention is, of course, no relation to me. Sachs's works had at that point not been translated, had not been distributed widely, and I must say, unfortunately, are not very well known today. She does not, her verse does not translate well, at least not terribly well to English. A number of years ago, I tried to dip into it and found that I couldn't connect with it in the translation, my ability to read German poetry being non-existent. There is precedent for this kind of shared prize. It's of course much more common in the sciences where researchers are working either in cooperation or in competition and thus advance the cause of wisdom. And when their achievements are apparent, they're awarded joint prizes. There was precedent for joint prizes in the literature field, although 1966 was actually the last time this happened. The constitution of the Nobel Prize states that in a shared prize, each recipient has to be worthy to have received the prize on their own. But just like in the sciences, when two people are working in one field of physics or biochemistry, and they're given the prize together to recognize their shared contribution, the choice of Agnon together with Nelly Sachs no doubt was a way for the Swedish Academy to say something about the state of the Jewish people. These two great Jewish artists, one writing Holocaust poetry in German, mind you, and the other, of course, the master of the modern Hebrew literature. There was no doubt that this was a decision to award the prize to, well, to the Jewish people, as it were, for what had been accomplished in the two decades after the Holocaust. Unusual as it was, on the Stockholm stage, Ingvar Andersson, the chairman of the committee, faced the two authors to make the presentation. And he tells them, Shmuel Yosef Agnon, Nelly Sachs, this year's literary prize goes to you both with equal honor for a literary production which records Israel's vicissitudes in our time and passes on its message to the peoples of the world. Mr. Agnon, in your writing we meet once again the ancient unity between literature and science as antiquity knew it. Your great chronicle of the Jewish people's spirit and life has a manifold message. For the historian, it is a precious source. For the philosopher, an inspiration. For those who cannot live without literature, it is a mine of never-failing riches. We honor you, the two of you, in combination of tradition and prophecy, of saga and wisdom. We honor you both this evening as the laurel-crowned heroes of intellectual creation and express our conviction that you have contributed to the human endeavor. And then Andersson quotes an earlier Nobel laureate, and he observes that a famous speech at a Nobel banquet, that of William Faulkner, held in this same hall 16 years ago, in which would have been 1950, contained an idea which he developed with great intensity. It is suitable as a concluding quotation which points to the future. In 1950, while the ashes were still settling over Europe, Faulkner, receiving the prize, said, I do not believe in the end of man. Faulkner is an interesting comparison to Agnon. I'm certain that the two authors did not know or read each other, but in Agnon, like in Faulkner, we confront the reality that you can take the boy out of the Buchach, but you can't take the Buchach out of the boy. Faulkner, the great author of the American South, created through words a wholly realized world, a disappeared world in his Yaknapatawpha County, the equivalent of Agnon's own Buchach. This county in Mississippi, which is the setting of most of Faulkner's writing, is a literary world that recalls a parallel to what Agnon was doing in trying to hold on to the lost Buchach. It's as if Agnon's Galician town or the Shtetlach of Eastern Europe were transported to the American South, and the Hasidim and Anshei Maaseh of Hebrew and Yiddish literature were replaced by good old boys and Southern belles. This, of course, is true for many great authors. We can think of Hannibal Mazura, of Mark Twain, the Weak Wake neighborhood of Newark, New Jersey, in Philip Roth's writings. We're, of course, mindful that James Joyce departed Dublin at the age of 22, around the same time that Agnon leaves his own town, virtually never to return, but yet never leaves it behind in the page. Faulkner's line, I do not believe in the end of man, was an attempt to convey the power of literature as a vivifying force. That somehow culture, that civilization itself, can be nearly destroyed, but in the spring, the buds will again emerge. In Agnon's writing, this was the message broadcast in the shadow of the Holocaust. doing so in Jerusalem, the capital of a new Jewish sovereign state, and in no delivery system less significant than the ancient Hebrew tongue, which had now been miraculously reawakened, like sleeping beauty, woken with the kiss. And that language becomes an alt-noi, an old-new, a renewed old language for a modern culture and literature. For Agnon, the receipt of the prize was also an affirmation of what the Hebrew language, as a language of Jewish life, of Jewish learning, of Jewish literature, had reached. Agnon had been an early combatant in the so-called Hebrew Wars. As Hebrew was being reawoken or revived during those early years before the establishment of the state, there were debates. There were ferocious, fierce debates that took place amongst the intelligentsia and amongst the popular press and amongst simple people about how will we take this language, the language of the synagogue, the language of the study hall, the language of the Bible, the language of the Siddur, of the prayer book, and how will we turn this language, which again has been, if not dead, then in a coma, this language of scholarship, and turn it into the language of the street. And there were significant debates about how this should be done, which path modern Hebrew should take. Agnon and his great colleague and elder mentor, the national poet Chaim Nachman Bialik, often found themselves on the opposite side of Eliezer ben Yehuda and his camp. Ben Yehuda, considered the reviver of modern Hebrew, had a certain idea of how the language should develop, and Agnon had his own ideas, as did others that sided in opposition to Ben Yehuda. Agnon believed that Hebrew could not be revived, because in order for something to be revived, it has to first be dead. And Hebrew was never dead, although sometimes it was in a deep sleep. It had been put in the freezer and needed to be defrosted. And the question of where do we look, which sources serve as the DNA of a new language, Agnon points to, well, actually some of these books behind me on the shelf, the classic canon of Jewish literature is the source from which the language could be reconstituted. It was precisely these sources, as I mentioned earlier, with which Agnon mined. He used them to find the raw material, particularly in the rabbinic literature, with which to craft his stories in his own distinctly Agnonian Hebrew. So back to the spotlight in Stockholm in 1966. We see Agnon rise to deliver his speech in Hebrew. Nary a soul in the auditorium could understand what he was talking about, aside from his family members and a few guests, the crowned heads of Europe, the diplomatic corps, minus representatives of the Arab nations, which of course boycotted the ceremony over the prize being given to an Israeli. Not one of them would have understood what he was talking about. Agnon's solution was to deliver his speech, or at least much of it, in Hebrew, and then to have the whole text read on his behalf in English. I want to turn our attention tonight to the text of the speech as a literary artifact. What does this one text, this first-person deliberate reflection on his art, on his writing, what does it tell us about what he thought his achievement and enduring legacy was? As a piece of rhetoric, Agnon's speech at the Nobel ceremony is actually somewhat bizarre. Of the slightly more than 2,000 words of the text in the English text, a solid half was an autobiographical presentation. By way of introduction, he quotes the Talmud. And he reminds his audience, presumably all of whom had been studying Daf Yomi, that it's said in the Talmud, in Tractate Sanhedrin, in Jerusalem, the Nikiye Hadda'at, the men of distinction, the men of discrimination, did not sit down to dine in company until they knew who their companions were to be. The Talmud gives a kind of piece of advice. You know, a person is traveling, maybe they put up at a wayside inn to gather their meal. Well, there's all types of characters you're going to encounter there. And it's not proper for a person of distinction to sit down to dine with somebody because maybe that person is of a lowly character or a bad virtue, and you wouldn't want that to rub off on you if you're a person of good manners and distinction. So one shouldn't dine in company unless you know who you're dining with. So he says, Your Majesty, King Gustav, and dearly assembled, we cannot gather together at this event unless you know who I am, because God forbid, I wouldn't want you to transgress this edict of the Talmud. And therefore, I will now tell you who I am, whom you have agreed to have at your table. Now, the most interesting passage of the speech is a quote, the money quote. It's so famous that for many years, for decades here in Israel, it was written in micrography along the side of the 50 shekel note which bore Agnon's countenance. Every Israeli that had at least a 50 shekel note in his pocket carried around this quote from the speech, although I'm not sure how many people put it under a magnifying glass to read. But it contains this statement about Agnon's biography. As I mentioned, Agnon's biography, or his autobiography, was amongst his greatest artistic creations. Everything about him, from his name to his date of birth to the date of his aliyah, his arrival in the land of Israel, everything was mythologized. Everything was part of the fable the author crafts about his own identity. It's a matter of historical record, of course, that his name is not Agnon, but Shmuel Yosef Tchatchkis. You know, like tchatchkis, you know, that little Yiddish phrase for trinkets. Agnon was a pen name he adopted upon arrival in Yafo. He was born in Buchach in the summer of 1887, but always insisted that he was born on Tisha B'Av, 1888. Tisha B'Av, the day of colossal national mourning, the day that marks the destruction of both Jerusalem temples, the day on which the ideas of Jewish exile and dispersion and the idea of Jewish redemption and return are both initiated. He claimed that the year of his birth, August 8th, 88, the numerically lyrical 8th of the 8th, 88, fell out on Tisha B'Av. Of course, this is not true. He was neither born in Tisha B'Av in 1888, nor in 1887, the summer in which he was actually born. He was born around then, a few days, a week and a half after. But for a writer possessed by a fascination with the relationship of the diaspora and the redemption and the exile and the return and the symbolism of having been born on this very weighted date of Tisha B'Av would have been of very significant importance. He anchors his own pen name, Agnon, in such an idea, deriving the name Agnon from his first story published in Hebrew upon arrival in the land of Israel, Agunot. But not the Agunot of estranged wives. In its colloquial sense today, an Aguna is a woman who, because of the mechanics of how Jewish divorce works, is unable to attain a get, a Jewish divorce, from her husband. And she's an Aguna, which according to a folk etymology might mean she's chained to this bad marriage. But Agnon is using it in the sense of igun, of the link, the chain that binds the Jewish people and their Father in heaven. If, according to the Midrashic mind, God and the Jewish people are compared to a groom and a bride. This is a rather well-known midrashic idea in the rabbinic literature, which allegorizes the relationship between God and the Jewish people as two lovers or husband and wife who stand under the mountain, which is held above them at the giving of the law at Sinai, the mountain itself being held above them, a symbol of the chuppah. The Torah, which is given through Moses, is the ketubah, the marriage contract. And the marital home, after all, is none other than the land of Israel in total or the Holy Temple in specific. So if this is a marriage, it's one that could use a little therapy. Because for 2,000 years, Agnon is observing at the beginning of the 20th century, husband and wife have not really been living together in their marital home because of the condition of Jewish exile. God, of course, never abandons his people. God, of course, would never divorce his beloved wife. But nevertheless, there has been a breakdown of how this relationship was midrashically imagined. In Stockholm, Agnon's biography may well have struck the uninitiated as rather odd, especially compared to other Nobel Prize speeches. What Agnon offered was not autobiography as autobiography. Rather, it was autobiography as midrash. In effect, what Agnon provided for the Swedish Academy and the world and readers over these many decades later is less biography, but myth, the myth of himself that melds into the myth or the mythos of the Jewish people. He gives us a portrait of the artist as a chronicler of the total Jewish experience. And here's the remarkable statement that Agnon made. He tells the audience, as a result of the historic catastrophe in which Titus of Rome destroyed Jerusalem and Israel was exiled from its land, I was born in one of the cities of the exile. But always I regarded myself as one who was born in Jerusalem. B'chol eit tamid domeh ha'iti alai, kemi shenolad b'Yerushalayim, he says in his thickly Galician accented Hebrew. In a dream, in a vision of the night, I saw myself standing with my brother Levites in the Holy Temple, singing with them the songs of David, king of Israel, melodies such as no ear has heard since the day of our city was destroyed and its people went into exile. I suspect that the angels in charge of the shrine of music, fearful lest I sing in wakefulness what I had sung in dream, made me forget by day what I had sung at night. For if my brethren, the sons of my people, were to hear, they would be unable to bear their grief over the happiness they have lost. To console me for having prevented me from singing with my mouth, they enable me to compose songs in writing. Now, like so many of the outlandish autobiographical claims that Agnon made, we can glean a lot from the story that he mythologizes about himself. Indeed, Agnon was a Levite, a Levi. One wonders why he felt compelled to mention this. Was the king going to call him up for the second aliyah in shul the next morning? I don't know. But the Levi'im, the temple Levites, among their tasks in the Holy Temple was to be musicians, to sing the songs of King David, to sing the poetry, the most beautiful poetry that had been composed by a Jewish pen. Why did he feel compelled to mention this? Because of the destruction of the temple, that was taken away from him. And unable to sing the songs of David Melech Yisrael, he decides to write stories. The 23 volumes in the collected Hebrew writings, the greatest achievement of modern Hebrew literature, are presented as a compensation for such holy work having been denied him. Agnon claims that he was compensated to compose in prose what was formerly sung in praise. Setting aside for a moment the grandiloquence of Agnon's move, we might consider just how his work serves as a consolation for the trials and tribulations of Jewish history. Agnon returns to this idea incessantly throughout his writing, both in works of fiction as well as in works of nonfiction. A moment later in the Nobel Prize speech, he tells the audience, "I was 5 years old when I wrote my first song, my first poem." Agnon uses song and poetry and prose almost interchangeably. "I was 5 years old when I wrote my first literary work. It was out of longing for my father that I wrote it. It happened that my father of blessed memory went away on business. I was overcome with longing for him, and I made a song." Elsewhere, in a different autobiographical sketch, he tells the story of that song. Agnon had a very happy childhood, and unlike many authors who feel the need to craft a fictitious world of strife in order to mine it for literary worth, Agnon's depiction of childhood is usually quite happy and quite harmonious. He was the beloved eldest child in his family. One gets the sense that the star and the sun and the moon and the stars in between all revolved around him. Every whim was indulged. He also came from privilege. He was from a well-to-do family that supported his interests. And again, even though he comes from a completely traditional background, it was the kind of open home in which a young Talmud student would also be encouraged to read world literature and poetry, which would have then been available to him in translation to German or Yiddish, or to Yiddish or Hebrew, or the German to whatever degree he was able to read it. And Agnon tells the story of one time his father, with whom he shared this very close relationship, with whom he studied one-on-one. Agnon's father was a merchant. He worked in the fur trade, but he was also a Talmid Chacham, a learned rabbi who had composed a commentary on Maimonides' epic code of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah. And they would study together, they would study Torah together every day. And the father goes away on business, and the young boy is inconsolate because father is away. And the absence of father is destabilizing. The kind of polytextured writing that we come to know in Agnon can be seen right here. The absence of father is the absence of his beloved Abba, but it can also be allegorized as distance from father in heaven, and it raises all types of questions about the absence of authority in the modern world. He comes home one day from cheder, from school, knowing that his father has not yet returned from his voyage. Samachti roshi lekotel uvachiti. I placed my head against the wall, against the doorpost, and I cried. Nit akra anacha milibi vekarati. Eifo ata abo abo. V'toch kedei amira nizdavga kriya shnia. Ahavti otcha ahava rabba. He's crying out, you know, the way little kids sometimes cry and they can't even catch their breath, and words are pouring out of him. And he describes it as he doesn't even know where they're coming from. And what are these words of longing? He's saying, Efo ata abba abba, father, father, where can you be found? Ohafti otcha ahava rabba, and I who love you with a love so profound. It's a rhyme. It's a couplet. For this, you don't win the Nobel Prize. But he points to this as the initiation into the world of literature. That almost unbeknownst to him, out of his tears, out of his anguish, comes a rhyme, comes something creative, comes the use of words and language to express something about his condition. And he's consoled by that. This kind of polytextured, multi-layered writing, this work which means what it means on the page and can also be allegorized for larger conditions in life and existence, particularly in Jewish life and existence, is something that I would commend to your attention as you'll read stories going forward in the coming weeks. Try to be mindful of how Agnon is saying one thing and another thing at the same time. This accounts for why a writer who was so obviously steeped in the old world of Yiddishkeit, of Eastern European Judaism, was also recognized and honored as one of the greatest of modern authors. It is the source of the complexity of his writing. Agnon wasn't claiming prophetic vision when he describes the mystery of these words coming out of him, but we do have this description of the artist as a young man and the initiation of the artist to his craft, the craft of writing. The art of composing is one that comes through some kind of nearly divine channel, divine inspiration, but it's depicted as the immediate, intense reaction to pain and loss and anxiety and suffering. That, at least, is the art of writing for Agnon. It's a response to suffering. It's a response to longing. It's about standing with one's hand on the handle of the lock, this biblical image from the Song of Songs, from Shir HaShirim, chapter 5. The two lovers are about to unite. In the allegorical reading of Song of Songs, of course, we're talking about the union of God, of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, and the Jewish people. But according to the simple reading of the text, you're talking about romantic love. And to know that your lover is on the other side of the handle of the lock, but if I tarry, if I delay, if I don't get out of bed and run to greet him, chamak, avar, he flies the coop, and I miss the moment. And I can't recapture it. That idea, that symbol of the little boy standing at the handle of the lock, al kapot ha-manul, becomes the image of, well, the uncertainty of the fulfillment of our desires. The great Israeli literary critic Gershon Shaked, observed that Agnon, like Franz Kafka, portrays, quote, the artist as a poeta della rosa, a poet whose torments become the source and substance of his work. But Agnon's most conscious poetic manifesto associates his creativity with a specifically nostalgic sorrow, a longing for the lost ancestral home as the wellspring of his work. Agnon's nostalgic mode is extremely profound. Nostalgia, of course, comes from the Homeric root of nostos, of homecoming. You remember Ulysses. And algia, pain, the pain of homecoming, the pain of knowing that you can't go home again. You can never step into the same river twice. The world that he's describing has slipped through his fingers like so much sand. Agnon's stories, particularly those of childhood and his hometown of Buchach, for example, a story such as The Kerchief, feature the element of the father going away, going off on business, going away to the fair, the mother waiting in anxious anticipation for his return. It's intensely multivalent. These stories brilliantly succeed in conveying that one single thing, that every single thing, means a multiplicity of things. In this light, we have to ask, when Agnon stood on the stage in Stockholm and said, as a result of the historical catastrophe that Jerusalem was destroyed and the Jewish people were exiled, I was born in one of the cities of the diaspora, but I always imagined myself as having been born in Jerusalem, what precisely did he wish the audience to understand? Agnon is making a very subtle move, I believe an intertextual one. In a kind of understated thematic intertextuality, he's drawing our attention to a different time that a Jew talked about singing or being unable to sing, which of course is what he's talking about earlier in the speech when he says, I'm not able to sing the songs of the Levite. I have to find an alternate form of creative composition because the songs of David in the temple have been stolen from me, have been taken from me. And I believe he's actually pointing to one of those very songs of David in the Psalms, Psalm 137, which you see here in the Hebrew text, but the next slide has the well-known words in English. By the waters of Babylon, Al Naharot Bavel, there we sat and wept as we thought of Zion. There on the poplar trees, we hung up our lyres, for our captors asked us for songs, our tormentors for amusement. Shiruna Shiretzio, sing for us those old songs of Zion. The Jewish exiles are taken off to Babylon and they put away their musical instruments. They hang them up on the poplars. It's like saying they put it in the back of the closet. They stored it away like all of my children's musical instruments that they learned for 6 months or a year in school and then somehow mysteriously disappear into the back of the coat closet, never to be played again. Because what purpose would we have in the exile by the waters of Babylon for our musical instruments formerly used in the service in the Holy Temple? And our captors, our tormentors say to us, give us those old songs. Hey, you remember those songs you used to sing in that temple of yours? Why don't you give us a ditty? Sing us a song. They're teasing. They're taunting. And when the Jews sing out, what song do they sing? Well, it's quite a song. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue stick to my palate if I cease to think of you, Jerusalem. If I do not keep Jerusalem in memory even in my happiest hour. You want a song of Jerusalem? I'll give you a song of Jerusalem, but not as we used to sing. I will give you a song composed here in Babylon, the song of exile in which we think back to Jerusalem. I was born in one of the cities of the exile, but I always imagined myself as if I were born in Jerusalem, because if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, Agnon might be saying between the lines. And then the singers in Babylon go on, remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they cried, strip her, strip her to her very foundations, destroy Jerusalem. Fair Babylon, you predator, a blessing on him who repays you in kind. A blessing on him who seizes your babies and dashes them against the rocks. Our great teacher here at Tikva, Ruth Weiss, who has done more than anyone else to teach us how to derive meaning from the canon of our classical texts for modern Jewish life and living. In her important book, Jews and Power, she points to the ambiguous relationship between Jews, Judaism itself, and power. Because you know, for all of those years of exile, power was something that we were at best adjacent to, that came with its own set of challenges, but it was not something that we properly possessed for ourselves. With the return to the land of Israel, the question is turned around. And many of Agnon's stories of Jewish life in the land of Israel, both immediately before and after the establishment of the state, deal with these questions, sometimes in a rather satirical vein of what does it mean for a people whose, you know, biggest job in the past was to, I don't know, organize the synagogue, who are now in charge of an army and a state and all of the related institutions. You can understand why that might be something that's ripe for satire. So Ruth in Jews in Power points to this very Psalm 137 as the bedrock for this problem. She observes that Judaism's much more ambiguous relationship to power likewise goes back to its earliest recorded history. Psalm 137 conveys the predicament of the captives in Babylon following the sack of Jerusalem. Their captors taunt the Jews by ordering them to perform songs of Zion. The Jews refuse, uttering instead the pledge that will resound through all the ages. If I forget you, O Jerusalem. When the Jews finally do sing out in that psalm, their tune is very different from the dirges that their captors demanded. Edomites are the generic enemies of Israel, Babylon the immediate aggressor. Rather than crushing the Jews' morale, the scorn of their captors has spiked Jewish anger and stiffened national resolve. The Psalm's grisly pledge of retribution, a term some scholars prefer to vengeance, offended those readers of the Bible who had no stake in the political rehabilitation of the Jews. Yes, for all its rhetorical severity, Psalm 137 does not exhort Jews to take up arms on their own behalf. Assuming full moral responsibility for the violence that war requires, it calls on the Lord to avenge the Jews' defeat, and on other nations to repay Babylon in kind. This reflects the historical record. It was the Persians, not the Jews, who defeated the Babylonians, and King Cyrus who allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem and to rebuild their temple, thereby inspiring Isaiah's reference to him as the Lord's anointed, the messenger of God's will. God's hand, not the soldiering of Israel, is credited with the Jews' political recovery. For had the Persians not prevailed and acted magnanimously, who knows how much longer it would have taken the Jews to return home. So I think that what Agnon is saying in Stockholm in 66 is a kind of very deeply embedded intertextual comment on Psalm 137. He's saying we cannot forget Jerusalem. The Swedish Academy has finally recognized the Jewish people, the Hebrew language, the nation, the state of Israel. And Agnon standing on European soil and asked to give a song. Sing us one of his songs. It's a song in the form of an acceptance speech, and the request is not by evil-minded tormentors, but by very kindly Swedish academicians who want to recognize his achievement. But nevertheless, there he is in the shadow of everything that had happened that century. And maybe he's saying, you want me to sing? I'll sing you a song. A song that tells what Jews do in the face of suffering and exile. We do not respond. We do not wage war. And if we do wage war in 1948, and if we'll do so again in 6 months' time during the Six-Day War, it's only out of defensive necessity. Instead, what's the most authentic Jewish response to suffering? Jews know what it means to live in exile. Ruth Weiss notes elsewhere in that book that the first Babylonian exile proved that the Jewish nation could survive outside of the land of Israel. We recall, of course, the famous notion of our homeland in the text, the Jewish book as a portable homeland. But this, of course, leaves open the question of when and how we would regain that physical homeland and how we would take that portable spiritual homeland and culture and canon back with us and reawaken it and give it meaning in a new Jewish state. At this point, Agnon might be asking, okay, Jews knew how to survive, and now we've returned. Do you know how Jews still survive? They survive in the text. But the texts have become transformed in modernity through renewed cultural production in our own language, in a new, authentically Jewish way. Creativity, in all its forms, creativity is the most authentic Jewish response to pain, to catastrophe, to exile, to destruction. From the catastrophe of history, mitoch katastrophe historit, he said, out of that historic catastrophe, we will write modern literature. That was Agnon's message in Sweden, at least according to my intertextual reading, delivered between the lines, receiving his Nobel Prize in Stockholm 55 years ago. The land of Israel, for a young boy in Poland in the 19th, 18th, 17th century, was just as magical as getting to Oz. It was just as distant as the dark side of the moon.